Then let's get started. And thank you very much to our host, Mrs. Kirzner, for hosting.
My pleasure.
This is a great story. Shoshana, you asked me, I think the last time I spoke, you asked me if I would do this story the next time. You were...
Can I just add one thing? This story, it was called to my attention by Rafael Viena, who's sitting right there on the sofa, and I had never seen it, never heard about it, and after I read it, I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with this story? And I decided I have to have a rabbi talk about this story, because it was so challenging as far as I was concerned, and when Rabbi Kirchner talks, you'll know what I'll speak.
It is definitely a challenging story. It's a fascinating story. And there's so much here, and there's so much detail, and we're not going to fit everything in. There's just absolutely no way to fit everything in. But we're going to take a good stab at trying to understand it. If you look at the sheets that I gave you, the first source on the sheet is just a link to a website, and I had to add in parentheses legal question mark, and really I should have just written illegal because I think it probably is. But they posted online translation of this story taken from a book in which it was translated, and so I'm pretty sure they're not supposed to do that. Pretty sure. Not 100% sure, or I wouldn't have given you the link, but nonetheless, it's there online for those who want to consult it to translate a particular word. You can see it there. This story is called Magalei Tzedek, Circles of Righteousness or Circles of Justice, although in some editions you will see it titled The Vinegar Maker, which is appropriate enough because that he's the protagonist and he doesn't have another name in the story. It was published in 1923 when Agnon was in Berlin. It was republished in the 1950s, 1960s in collections. It's a beautiful story, and it's a troubling story. There's a lot of misery in this story. If you take a look at source number two, I brought you a piece from Gershom Scholem, who, of course, was close with Agnon, December 1967, Commentary Magazine. He writes, Agnon began by writing short stories, and it is in this mode that he has achieved a perfection which leaves the reader breathless. More than 20 years of intense productivity passed before he published his first long book. The secret of their perfection, the perfection of the short stories, lies in Agnon's compression of an infinite wealth of detail into infinitesimal space. Unsurpassed in this respect are his masterpieces of fiction. In the third volume of his collected writings, many of these tales are suffused with an atmosphere of immense sadness, while at the same time they hold out a promise of consolation. There is, for example, the story of Azriel Moshe, the porter, an ignoramus who grows enamored of the books in the great library of the Beth HaMidrash and teaches himself the titles of all the books whose contents he will never be able to grasp. This Azriel Moshe becomes the keeper of the library, dying a martyr's death while shielding the books with his body in the hour of persecution. Another story, our story, concerns an impoverished vinegar maker, all alone in the world, who saves up diligently in order to make his way to the Holy Land. Uncertain as to where he should hide his money for safekeeping, he places it in an alms box under a crucifix on the road. Upon coming finally to fetch his cash, the vinegar maker is arrested for robbing sacred funds. He is imprisoned and condemned to die, but is visited in his cell by that man, as Jesus is called in Hebrew, who takes him to Jerusalem, where he is found dead by his compatriots. That's a good digest of the story. But his point about the sadness with an element of consolation at the end, it is so true as a comment on it. Now, you already see, first of all, have people here all read the story?
No.
Right? I'm not going to challenge and ask anyone to admit if they didn't. But when the story is republished, the story is received in some circles as Agnon flirting with Christianity.
For sure.
And we'll see it in a moment. I will note, just because this is going to come up over and over again as I speak, some people call him Yeshu. Some people call him Jesus. From a halachic perspective, as I understand Jewish law, it is fine to use either name. There is a commandment in the Torah that says that the names of other gods or the gods of others shall not be mentioned, but his first name is not the name of a deity. It's what, you know, it's his first name. He was called that in grade school, presumably. His last name may be another story, but in any case, that's the name that I'll use. I'll go back and forth probably between Jesus and Yeshua, and it's the same person. But if you take a look at source number 3, this is an open letter written to Shai Agnon, as quoted by Arela Abramson in an article called Magalei Tzedek. The letter's from 1960, when the story is republished. I didn't translate this particular paragraph. All the other sources I translated, but this one I did not, simply because there are certain clauses in it where I'm not sure what the intent is. So I'm going to read it aloud now and offer translation, but it's written in this sort of quasi-artistic Hebrew. Im hofa'ato, with the appearance of this story, he'ir alav dalid sadan, shtok, Professor Sadan, who at that point his last name was Shtok, he was still in Europe, challenged the story. Ki yesh bo mishum mizmut im oto ha'ish, that it involves an element of flirting with, I think is probably the best translation, flirting with oto ha'ish. Oto ha'ish is the term in rabbinic Hebrew for Jesus, that man, as he is called, he who shall not be named, for Harry Potter fans. So there's a flirtation in your story with that man, and you'll see why very clearly when we talk more about the story. Chet Greenberg, his kirchav begino, beina nizkakim lenosei yashan be'ah, lenosei yeshu, it should be, that's an optical character recognition problem, to be yeshu, be'ahava. Chet Greenberg mentioned you as a result of this story as being among those who associate themselves lovingly with Yeshu, even though you are a religious Jew, he continues to say. With a polemic of fire, I should note, by the way, that at the time when Agnon wrote the story and published the story, I think those were actually his years when he had left religious practice. I don't think he ever fully left it, but there is that period in the 1920s when he seems to have stepped away before coming back later. So he's religious by the time you get to the 50s and 60s when it's republished. But originally, when it was written, he was not. Continues to note that Lieberman mentioned, also Chaim Lieberman mentioned in that same polemic, to your disgrace, and then our master Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Herzog. Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Herzog was the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel. He was, according to papers that were uncovered in the last year or two, the drafter of the prayer for the State of Israel, along with Agnon. Agnon made comments on it, and it's him with her. Like someone just said something? Was something else? No? Okay. So he has requested that you recant from this story and that you bury it. As well as your classic commentator, or your brilliant commentator, or your regular, however you want to read it, Dr. Kurzweil, cannot find a way to translate this story, to explain this story, that puts the mind at ease. So this is an open letter written to Agnon, challenging him about the Christian overtones of this story. And the truth is, it's not just overtones. It's also in the imagery of the story. There are various iterations of the number 3 where they don't seem to be warranted, that suggests some form of Trinity. Of course, the title of the story, Magalei Tzedek, comes from where? Tehillim, but not just any Tehillim. Chapter 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not. Right? The ones that the church calls its own. It's funny. In my first synagogue, I remember I went to officiate at my first funeral in the local funeral home, and I did my own translations. I did things in Hebrew and in English as part of the service, but I did my own translations. So I get up there to lead people in this chapter from Tehillim, from Psalms, and I had done my own version of a translation of Psalm 23 because I felt like the well-known version had been so Christianized. And also certain terms in it weren't translated quite the way I liked it. So I start leading everybody in, and I turn around afterwards and it's up on the wall in large print behind the speaker. I just hadn't noticed it. But this psalm, which is so well known, is taken by Christians and used in their liturgy. Vinegar, one of the principal images in this story, is offered to Yeshua on the cross. There's a lot. If you look at number 4 on the sheet, I gave you references to essays that relate to this story. I have to admit that the book, which is number 5, The Time of Cruel Miracles, Mythopoesis, and Dostoevsky and I've Known, and Professor Landau's article, both of those I didn't actually read. The book, because it's only available on Google Books, I couldn't find it locally or for free. And Professor Landau's essay I came across too late. But the other ones are very interesting. And Professor Ezrahi, the second bullet point in number 4, she does a lot to build up the Christological associations. So one of the questions which leads people to be fascinated with the story is, are the critics right? What are the messages of this story? Are we meant to take flirtation with Christianity as an element of the story? So the answer is no. But the question is, how do you get there? So what is this story? So I want to review the basic narrative and then jump into the story itself. Those who have been at classes before with me, please, you jump in any time. Don't wait till the end because there won't be time. That's important to me. Here.
I just want to know how long have I known being in Europe, in Berlin, when he wrote that story?
4 years, I believe. I think he went in 1919. He went with Schocken on a trip and then ended up there, staying there. He met his wife, Esther Marx, in Berlin. And then eventually, remember, he was born in Europe. Then he made Aliyah in, I think, 1909. Then he went on this trip with Schocken, and then he came back to Israel after that. But I think he had gone as early as 19. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I think he had gone as early as.
He spent 10 years in Germany.
Spent 10 years in Germany.
This is before everything burned up there.
Yes. So the story starts out with an old man who has suffered terribly. He's anonymous. We never learn his name. He descended from wealthy winemakers, but undescribed circumstances have made him into a vinegar maker instead. They're not actually winemakers. They're wine merchants, I should say. The business is clearly less lucrative than the wine business, and exposure to the acid of the vinegar is bad for him. He loses his wife when his children are very young. His children were conscripted into the Polish army, and they died in battle. His home is decrepit. It's falling apart. Even his connection to God gives him no joy. That's our introduction. However, love of Israel is strong in him, and he sets a goal of Aliyah. He wants to move to Israel. He just wants to be buried there, to find a grave in the dirt of the land of Israel, and the focus on burial repeats significantly within the story. He starves himself, fasts on Mondays and Thursdays, avoids pleasure, in order to save up his money to travel to Israel. He splits the money, half for his Israel fund and half for himself. He stores the fund, as we saw in Sholem's digest, he stores the money in a public charity box that happens to be held by a statue of Yeshu by the road. Why? Because he is described in the story as Tamim. He's somebody who is just very simple, very straightforward, doesn't really grasp nuances, and doesn't understand, except that there's this nice-looking statue out there. So he feels great joy for the first time from this drive to make Aliyah. And he marks his weekly contributions of funds by making notches on his vinegar container. And he dances at night, in the middle of the night, with the container that he used to hold the vinegar. He's distracted constantly by thoughts of Aliyah, even from religious service, even from taking care of his home, paying his taxes, so much so that had he not ultimately taken the money, gone to jail, and so on, they say he would have gone to jail because of not paying his taxes, or his house would have fallen down around him.
It was.
Literally fallen down. That would have been it. He can't bring himself, though, to actually go through with the plan as long as the container is whole. He's stuck in his cycle. More about that later. Finally, the container bursts because of all the notches he's made in it, and he's ready to go. So he goes to the statue to get his money, which happens to be so full, the box is so full, that the coins were poking out of it the last time he went to make his donation. So we don't know who else is ever looking at this box, but it happens to be that on the day that he goes to get the money, priests have come from Rome to empty the box. You know, for all we know, they did this regularly, and he just never went to get the money. We don't know. But they see him about to smash the container, and they have him arrested for the attempted theft. He is tried. He is convicted. He acknowledges in court, yes, I went to take the money, right? Not recognizing that this is not the thing you say to the judge. And he can't understand why it is that everyone is saying things that are true, right? They're telling the truth that they saw him about to take the money. He's telling the truth that he wanted to take the money, and yet they're holding him in jail.
It's his money.
Yes, he says it is his money, and they don't really take that very seriously. In court, he sees that they have this picture of same figure as the statue, smiling at him, and he sees that as mockery. Well, in the jail, he cries bitterly. He complains to God about all he did to get to God's land of Israel, and now his money is gone, and he's in prison. He can't really sleep well. At midnight, he wakes up, and he sings sad songs, and then he sees a person with a stone box. And lo and behold, it is once again Yeshu. The man picks him up, because he's in the chains, the man picks him up and brings him to Israel in three flights. Notice once again the image of three things. And while in flight, being who is carrying him turns cold. He himself turns cold. He falls away when he enters Israel, and it falls to the ground, and that night, the community's kolel in that instance does not mean an institution where people sit and study Torah. Kolel is an institution for taking care of communal needs, including needs for charity. And they see angels bringing him in, and they bury him that night because we don't leave a body overnight in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, funerals happen even at night. That's your story. Interestingly, Agnon publishes it initially in a section in Elu Ve'elu called Sipurei Polin, Stories of Poland. However, it's republished in honor of its 50th birthday in 1938 in Sipurei Eretz Yisrael, Stories of the Land of Israel. And you can see why. It makes sense. On the one hand, there's an element of satire of Polish Jewry, which we're going to come back to. And on the other hand, there's a critique of Zionist efforts as well. So you could fit it into either one. So again, there's so much to say. And until I saw that there was a readily available translation, I was actually going to do a translation and give it out, which I've done, you know, for some of the other stories we've done. But since it's out there, I didn't do that. But I want to call your attention to some elements of language before we talk about the meaning of the story. So a few things. First of all, the title of this story. What does it suggest to you, knowing the story? What does the title suggest? Magilei Tzedek.
Circularity.
Excellent. There is this element, and Arela Abramson talks about this a lot in her essay. There is an element here of a life lived in circles and cycles. So, for example, when I put it on your sheet, if you look at source number 5, three times we get repetitions of the phrase Chamisha Yamim Bashavua, that 5 days a week he did this, 5 days a week he did that. We have five repetitions of the phrases associated with him splitting the funds, half going here, half going there. I gave you the page numbers based on the Elu Ve'elu publication of the story. So if you have Elu Ve'elu, you would be able to track it in there. Three repetitions of the phrase Betoch Kach Avru Kamash Shanim, that in the course of this activity, several years passed. You have the very fact that his whole life is a loop. One of the things I'm going to come back to is the link between this old man and Eov and Job. And that's really striking. A couple of you were with me when we learned the book of Job and know that it's close to my heart. But Job describes his own life as a loop early in the book when he says, Arom yatzati mi beten imi v'arom ashuv shama. Right? He says, unclothed, with nothing, I left my mother's womb and I'm going to go back there with nothing. Right? When he's lost everything. And you see that same idea of his life as a loop for him. Because also, he loses his wife, he loses his children, he doesn't have anything at all. We're going to come back to the Job links, but that's also part of the sense of circularity. Everything goes around and around for him, and he can't get out of the circle, as I said before, until the vat breaks. And the story says that twice Right? It says he did it again and again because that's what tmimim do. That's what simple people do, is once they've latched on a way of doing things, they're just going to keep on doing it. And he can't break out of it as long as the vat is intact. That's number one. Number two, here's something which I didn't see anybody comment on, but I think it's so clear in the story, and I don't understand. I think it's pshat. This is the way to read it. When it first speaks about his love of the land of Israel, it uses a phrase, "Ahavat Eretz Yisrael hayta tikua bilibo." The love of the land of Israel was tikua, tafkuf vav ayin hey, in his heart. What does tikua mean? Stuck in. More than that. Stabbed in. It's to be stabbed in. Now that phrase comes up all the time in rabbinic Hebrew. For something to be takua bilibo, but where does it come from? So for that you need a good CD-ROM that you can use for searching, or a good knowledge of Tanakh. But either one will do. If you take a look at source number 6, Shmuel Bet, the death of Avshalom is the first time we find that phrase used. Yoav takes shlosha shvatim bechapo. He takes 3 spears in his hand. Vayitka'em belev Avshalom. He stabs them into the heart of Avshalom. That's the first reference we have in Jewish sources to something being stabbed into one's heart, and it is an expression of violence. And you think about it, because what killed the old man? What killed the old man? Avad Eretz Yisrael. It was absolutely embedded in his heart in a very positive way. But it was also his death. It was also his demise. He starved himself. He ignored all of his needs. He put his money into this box and ended up being thrown into jail as a result. It was his love, and it was the death of him. I think I've known he does that intentionally. Yeah.
It's probably also true of the kupah that he used as reminiscent of either Keren Kayemet or of Meir Balanes. The pushkas that people had in their homes.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
To make that a Christian symbol is even more frightening. And remember, yes, also 1921, it was considerable opposition to the Zionist idea.
Right. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, although more from the perspective of the Zionists. But we're going to talk about Christians and Jews and Zionism, that's going to have to come up. But I like that, the pushka idea. I hadn't thought about it at all, but I think you're exactly right. That's an element of it. Yes, Pearlie.
I think that the idea, after a deal, he comes to terms with whatever has befallen him. But here, he dies, and that's really the Christian symbol as well, so that this is the way to salvation, the way to the new life. I'm not saying that that Adnan was becoming a Christian. He could have been playing with this information, you know, playing with it as a tool for liberty.
We'll come back to what he's doing.
But anyway, that's what I see, and that it's a continuation of the Trinity numbers and all that stuff.
Right. Good. But so we're going to come back to this.
The motive of the Geulah is certainly very strong. And when you speak with Adnan about Geulah, you'd be very skeptical. And very, very suspicious. He is not like that. And he's very sarcastical. He just takes the story of Maaseh Ha'ev.
Yes.
Where the Geulah is, you shech the one that he's supposed to.
Yes. Oh no, I've known this.
He's not a big fan of this machine for him.
I'll use the phrase I was waiting to use until later. Avnon likes to prank the reader. In an earlier time, you might have said he likes to yank your chain. He wants to get you going in a particular direction in order to laugh at your reaction. That's very consistent with him, and you'll see that when we talk about the redemption theme within the story. But I'm just stuck on the language right now. He has an image, which is a fascinating image, and I think he's playing it doubly. When he talks about how the old man was bent like a shofar and groaned like a shofar. And the reason I say that this is double, I gave you one reference in source number 7, where the Talmud discusses how a shvarim or truah sounds, the sound of the shofar, and has a debate as to whether it is the 3 longish sounds that we're familiar with, two, 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 or whether it's the staccato ululation type of wailing, two, 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 right? And the term for the longer cry is goneach, which is the same term Agnon uses to describe how he is goneach from his heart. He portrays him as a shofar. That's one layer, but there's another layer. Because the Talmud has a phrase for the staka boxes that they had in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple. The Talmud's word for it is the shofar. That's the term for the staka box that they have. So he is the old man is a shofar, and he lives with this shofar that is his vat that he uses to cut the staka herb.
I was thinking number three is also in the Jewish world, which is barim, and you know. So
oh yeah.
Maybe there's.
Three can be Jewish.
Between the two, maybe.
I see everyone wants to go towards the Christian things, but I'm going at my pace. I'm going to do it. But yes, Irv, you are correct. Three, they don't have a copyright on the number three.
Right.
Nor do they have a copyright on numerology. We were there first. Another point, he describes God as being mantik et hamar, yes. Sweetening that which is bitter. Well, that's a straight out biblical line, right?
Also, there's a Gemara in there.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it is. There is a Gemara on that very issue with the whole Maaseh. Anyway.
Okay, because I'm not sure which one you'd be referring to, but I'm talking about Mara. When the Jews get out of Egypt and they camp at Mara and the water is bitter, and then they take the wood and put it in and it becomes sweet, God is the one who sweetens the bitter. Yes?
It struck me because of this business that the family did wine and this guy did vinegar.
Yes.
Yeshayahu, Mashallah Kerem, and I think it's a whole man's story.
Interesting. And it's an interesting idea. You're right. Yeshai, the fifth parak, has his Mashallah Kerem about Kerem Hayali Didi, that my beloved had a vineyard and they produced b'ushim, bad fruit for all the work that I put into it. It's an interesting point for sure. We find the description of his cry going from one end of the house to the other, Misof Habayit Vad Sofo, which is a phrase the Talmud uses in source number 9 to describe the sound of the soul leaving the body, traveling Misof HaOlam Vad Sofo. It's the sound of death. The fact that the angel travels with him three flights to get to Israel is fascinating because it doesn't belong. Meaning, the Talmud has a description in Brachot about different angels and how long it takes them to travel to their destination. And this one needs one step, and this one needs two steps, and this one needs four steps. None of them need three steps. And there's a sense that he's pranking you with the image. Granted that three could be a Jewish number also, there's a sense that he deliberately picks this three. Final note before we get to the layers of the story. And that is, just because it bothered me, he has the rooster crow waking him up, and he does Tikkun Chatzot, the prayers of midnight, to mourn for the temple. I was raised to think that the rooster crows in the morning. Ha! Huh, what do I know? I don't grow up on a farm. The truth is, I spent 2 years in Shiva Karim B'Yavne in Israel, and there was a chicken farm right next door, and it's true, we heard the roosters crowing all the time. They had no idea what time of day or night it was. So I gave you a link, though, for a fascinating article from Scientific American in source number 10, what time does the cock crow? And it turns out that various cultures use the rooster as the timer for various religious ceremonies that happen at night, including midnight rituals. So the answer is yes, the rooster can crow at midnight, and you can use that as your alarm clock if you wish. Yes.
No, but it's an exact opposition to the first bracha.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Well, except that I don't think he's playing with that because he doesn't use the word sechvi. I think if he wanted to, he would have used it.
I guess, but there it says lavchim, here it says
it's not been mafkin, right? But I feel like he would have called you. You know, he would have called it to mind if that was what he meant. That's what I would have expected. Okay, so that's just a bit about some of the language because I just love his language. We're going to talk more about his language as it fits into the different layers of the story. But here we go. The old man in this story is, as I said, anonymous, and in truth, he has many identities. All within what he does within the story. On one level, he is a simple Jew who makes up what he lacks in ritual with his loving commitment to the land of Israel. He has a Jewish heart, if you will. That's one layer for the old man, and we'll see it will correspond to a layer within the story. In another layer, He's an ardent Zionist whose sole joy in life comes from the dream of making Aliyah. Third layer.
To be buried.
To be buried, yeah.
To be buried. This is not
we're getting there.
This is very, very, very... we all
have
Israel, and we all want to be buried there, etc., etc., etc.
True. It's not Zionism in the sense of wanting to build a state. But keep in mind, this is 1923. His vision may not stretch that far. The third, we're getting there. Really. The third layer. He is an unintentional devotee of the Christian Savior, saved from prison by the image of that Savior. You can't ignore that layer of the story. Fourth, he is the victim of a justice system that is directed by prejudice and does not pursue truth. And fifth, he is a Baal Tshuva. He is somebody who repents, comes to God, in the course of his pursuit of Aliyah. All of these are in the story. But the common theme in all of them is, as I said before, the old man is an Iyov. He is a Job. He suffers terribly and remains loyal to his vision. And we, the reader, are meant to learn from the experience. We see it, obviously, in the loss of his wife, the loss of his children, the loss of his wealth. The vinegar theme plays out the sourness of his life. But it isn't just that. Consider this. He is a manufacturer of vinegar. How do you manufacture vinegar? What do you do?
Sour wine.
You take wine and you put it in conditions that will make it go bad. He doesn't only have a life of vinegar. His life is one of producing vinegar, taking that which had been good and making it bad. You can't skip that piece of it. In fact, the image of the vat in which he stored the vinegar is fascinating. If you had to come up with a term in Hebrew for a receptacle that one might use to hold liquid, right, a substantive amount of liquid, not a kos. A kos is a cup. That's too small. But what might you use?
Anything but ketone.
Anything but ketone. Cod would have been a good one, sorry.
A can,
but ketone is an odd word. Yeah?
I said bakbuk.
Bakbuk, maybe. That would have been good. He used ketone. Well, the word ketone, Agno knows very, very well, because it's one of these midrashim that you learn as a little kid in school, in yeshiva, because you learn it at the time of Sukkot. I brought it for you in source number 11. It's actually from a Mishnah.
Is it Greek?
Probably in its origin, I would guess Greek, but I didn't look it up. It's a good guess, though. So the Mishnah describes somebody who sits in the sukkah when it's raining. Yardu shamim, the Mishnah asks, Me'im atay mutar lifnot? When are you allowed to leave the sukkah if it's raining? Misha tisra hamikba, when your food is ruined. And then they say, Mashlu mashal amah davar domeh. They made a comparison. They said, what's that like when you get rained out of the sukkah? La'evet shabal limzo kos l'rabo. A slave who goes to pour a cup for his master, v'shafach lo ketone al panav, and the master pours his pitcher before him, literally in his face. The ketone is the rejected gift. That's what the ketone is. Agnon is channeling this idea that this is his gift, this is what the old man has for God, and that God is rejecting it. Based on the life that this man is leading, he seems to be rejected by God. He remains loyal, though, to his ideals. Despite his suffering, despite the exhaustion that these very ideals, saving for the land of Israel, are bringing upon him, and in the end, he reaches his goal. His loyalty brings him reward. He's able to arrive in the land, and all he ever wanted was to be buried there, and that's exactly what he got. And his entire experience of suffering teaches the reader a lesson. Although the lessons we're going to learn are less about the old man and more about the events that befall him. But this is what you're seeing here. This is a version of the Job story. And I think it's really striking to see it play out in this way. Because each facet of the old man's character, the simple Jew, the Zionist, the accidental Christian, the victim of injustice, the Baal Tshuva, the penitent Jew, all of these play as their own layers within the story. And even though this is written at a time when I think Agnon is not observant, each of the layers expresses Torah values in a very clear way. His messages that he provides in the story are coming out of the Judaism that he has learned, and we'll see that, you know, as we go through it. It's really striking. Clear so far? I know I went a little quickly with some of the language imagery, but we're going to catch some of it again as we go through the layers of the story. Yeah.
One question with the Job connection.
Yeah.
Job suffers such a terrible devastation, but he never loses his faith in God.
Right.
But this protagonist starts out by losing his faith in God, and he has to reclaim it with the direction towards
See, you're right, but I think that's why I worded it the way I did, that it's not about God for him. His loyalty is not Job's loyalty to God. His loyalty is to the land of Israel. And he never loses that. And that's the source of his reward. It's not about God for him until you get to the end of the story.
No, but once he makes claim towards that goal, he does become faithful. He goes back to the Torah. He goes back to observance.
And I don't know that he ever left it.
It says he left it.
We're going to discuss it. You'll see what I'm trying to tell you. But what I'm saying is that the Job aspect of loyalty, for Job is loyalty to God. For the old man is loyalty to the land of Israel. That's what I'm getting at. We'll talk more about his relationship with God. We're not through with him.
Job is a much more complex character than what you're dealing with.
This is a short story. He doesn't have 42 chapters to play with.
I just wanted to point out that after reading it 2-3 times, that it struck me very much at the beginning how he had become very, when he was going downward, how he became careless with the talit, with his and that one little hint is tells you a lot about what happened to his spiritual life, to his relationship to God. But once he decides to make Aliyah, he becomes, as Israel said, I think there's a tremendous closeness to God, but of course it's secondary, it's secondary to his Aliyah thought.
So again, we're going to come back to his relationship with God. We're not there yet.
I like the expression of Aliyah to you. It's not Aliyah. It's not what we conceive today as Aliyah,
right? Oh, no. It's very much
the Aliyah. No, it's not Aliyah. Yeah. This is something that generation and generation and generation and generation Jews have dreamed. They took the little bag of Afar Eretz Israel, of the sand of Israel, put it on my eyes. This was the love of the land that is not earthy, that is not...
So what... Right.
It is not the concept that we have today of Aliyah is a political concept, is a national concept. It's not... This is a totally spiritual concept.
So I would contend that no one can co-opt and trademark the word.
That's true, but the fact is that we live in a...
Yeah,
but Agnon is in the same...
Agnon actually has other stories about the desire to be buried in the land of Israel. He has a story about somebody who asked for earth to be brought back for him by Israel. You know, the idea of desiring to be there just for burial is one that I want to come back to. I'm trying to do this with a particular structure, and I think that it's useful to follow the structure, and that's why I am sticking to it. But we'll see more about this. It's not going to be one-sided. So, the first layer, the human layer, the injustice. This story, in part, is a cynical satire of human justice. And that's a fairly self-evident read. I wondered, and I did a little bit of looking and didn't find anything. Maybe someone here has some familiarity. Does anybody know anything about the influence of the Dreyfus trial on Agnon?
No.
I couldn't find anything about it, but there has to have been. I mean, I
read that he actually attended one of the congresses, the Zionist congresses.
He would have been very young. I mean, well, not by the end of them.
He went to one of them?
Not by the end of them. I mean, he's 1888. So, he could have gone. And he would have been a late teenager or something. Yeah. No, it's possible. I wonder about the Dreyfus influence and the idea that the Christian court is biased against the Jew. I wonder if that's any influence. But what we do know about Agnon throughout his writing is that he is an iconoclast. He doesn't have faith in political institutions. He's something of a cynic about them. And we see that it come up in different ways in his stories. And it for sure comes out here. And here, this was something that once it caught my eye, I couldn't stop seeing it. What's the title of the story? What's the title of the story? Magale Tzedek. What should the title of the story be?
Maybe Nafshi Yishuv.
That's true. No.
Righteousness.
What's the wording in the pasuk? In the Torah, in Tehillim, the wording is bimagilei tzedek. Right? Yancheini bimagilei tzedek. I aspire that God should guide me to this place of righteousness where there is righteousness. The story is called magilei tzedek. This is it. These are the circles of righteousness. This is what you get. Agnon drops the bet. It frustrates me when I see writers write about the story and put the bet in. Agnon deliberately took it out. This is not aspirational. This is where it is, and yet it is unjust. Here's your Magalei Tzedek, pal. Let's see how you like it. And it fits beautifully with the Chometz Ben Yayin image in the story. When the people find out that this vinegar maker has tried to break open the charity box and steal it for himself, they call him a phrase which Agnon telegraphed from the beginning of the story, Chometz ben Yayin, vinegar son of wine. That's a phrase that comes from the Talmud. And a particular story you may be familiar with, the sage Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Agnon liked Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, but that's a story for another time. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is the one who went to live in a cave on the run from the Romans. He has a son, Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, who also goes into the cave and lives with him in the cave. They come out, and they can't accept anything this worldly. They've been living an ascetic, type of a lifestyle away from everything, and they can't bear to see people farming. But at some point, Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, undergoes some kind of a change. Because he starts colluding with the Romans. Take a look, please, at this story in source number 12. In the interest of time, I'm just going to read my English translation, but you can see the original there as well. Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, advised a government police officer about how to catch a thief. He gave him a whole strategy. Go into the tavern at a certain hour and see if the person is falling asleep over his beer. And if he has this kind of work, then fine. If he doesn't have that kind of work, then he must be a thief and he was up all night stealing things. So that's the strategy. So the police officer is really impressed. Word gets back to the government about this strategy that Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, advised. And he said, let the reader of the scroll be the one to carry it out. So they brought Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, and he caught thieves. He became a police officer catching thieves within the Jewish community. So Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha sent the following message to Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon. Chometz ben Yayin, vinegar son of wine, how long will you pass the nation of our God to be murdered? And Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, responded, I'm just getting rid of thorns from the vineyard, to which he said, let the owner of the vineyard come and eliminate his own thorns. That's not for you to do. So when I read that story, it strikes me that the image of vinegar son of wine is an image, it's an accusation of being unjust. Why are you doing this? You're taking people, you're taking Jews, and turning them over to the Romans. Even as he believes that he is being just. Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon thinks he's justified in what he's doing. This old man is accused of theft and being vinegar, son of wine, but in his mind, he thinks that he is just. And the Jewish values here are very clear. I brought you one source, just because you have to have a source. So I brought you source number 13 from Kohelet, from Ecclesiastes, right, where Shlomo says, "Va'od ra'iti tachat ha'shemesh, I saw under the sun, mekom ha'mishpat shama ha'resha, mekom ha'tzedek shama ha'rasha." In the place of judgment, that's where the wicked one is. In the place of righteousness, that's where the wicked are. In other words, a statement that justice in this world is perverted by the wicked. And that's your first and most basic layer of the story. Before you get to Christianity, before you get to Zionism, it's the fact that here you have an old man who is suffering, and the court does not give him a fair hearing, and he is condemned by everybody, despite the fact that he hasn't done anything wrong. That's your first layer. It's the simplest layer. Second layer is a religious layer. And it's an ode to the simple Jew. Background here. The battle between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim includes a fight over the role of ritual observance and Torah scholarship. Now, that's changed a lot over the years. Hasidim aren't Hasidim anymore. Misnagdim aren't Misnagdim anymore. We've all sort of blended into the middle. But back in the day, when there was a real rift to the early Hasidim, the essence of Jewish life was something that Hasidim would call Dveikus. You call it Dveikut if you like, but the Hasidim would have called it Dveikus, which means to cling to God, to cleave to God. Whereas the Misnagdim believe in Shlemut, Shlemus, being complete. Meaning, to a Misnagdim, the ideal in life is you can check all the boxes. You did all of the mitzvot, you studied all of the Torah. To the Chassid, the question is, yeah, but did you love God while you were doing it? Did you think about God while you were doing it? Yeah?
You have the Chassid and then you have the Mitnaged.
Yes!
Just think back to that.
What do you mean?
The Mitnagdim were different to the Chassidim.
Right.
So, how would they sort of meld together?
Well, they melded together because the Hasidim stopped being such purists about their ideology. So, for example, early Hasidic thought said, if I'm sitting there on Pesach and I'm holding the matzah and I don't have proper concentration, I shouldn't eat the matzah. I should wait. And even if it was weeks later, eventually I'll do it when I get proper concentration. That's the pure form of the Hasidic idea.
Is that the Kavanah business?
You betcha. And the pure form of the Mitnaged is ritual, scholarship. That's what we do. This is the mark of perfection. And did I do with this group the story Hanidach? Hanidach is the most perfect expression of this. If you haven't read it, read it.
Not with you, but we did.
So it's the most perfect expression of this issue. Is you have the two sides there, and the one who's caught in between, the kid from the staunch Misnagdic family, whose heart, his heart longs for Hasidus, and he can't be there because his family is prohibiting it. And it's a terrible story, and it's a beautiful story at the same time. But Agnon loves, absolutely adores this theme. I brought you more about Hasidim and Misnagdim from an article by a friend of mine in number 14, but I'm not going to take the time for it right now. But your ideal story, your ideal Hasidisha story, is the story of the kid who walks into shul on Rosh Hashanah and doesn't know the words for the davening and, say, plays his flute. Or he just says the letters of the Aleph Beis or whatever. There are different versions of it, but it's all the same idea, which is you don't have to get it right in order to be meaningful to God. It's more important that you give your heart to God. That's the Hasidish view. So those battles between Hasidim and Misnagdim are really important in Agnon's writing. Hanidach, it's the whole story. A guest for the night, also about it. Shalom, shalom, ve'in shalom, also about it. Good, right. But Agnon's family has the split. His father's family was Hasidish. His mother's family was Misnagdish. Buchach was itself a hotbed for the strife between Hasidim and Misnagdim long before Agnon came along at the end of the 18th century. In Hanidach, he actually, one of the key figures is a play on Rabbi Avram David of Buchach, also known as the Eshel Avram, who was a misnaged, who was drawn to Hasidus.
And Tehillah.
And paid the price for it. So I have to admit, I've only read excerpts from Tehillah. I'm not an expert in Tehillah.
But I think the Hasidim and the Gnagdim made peace because there was a greater danger to Judaism. The whole Enlightenment movement was beginning, mm-hmm. and they were afraid of that. If we have the original war, we will lose the battle.
That's an unusually hopeful idea for Agnon. In terms of this story, Agnon, as he does elsewhere, takes the side of the Hasidim. Right?
Why?
Why does he take the side of Hasidim? His father took him to the Klois when he was young. And I think he has a real attachment from that. But he does it in many of his stories. In Hanidah, the right side is clearly the Hasidish side. Sorry?
I'd say he's not.
You would say he is not himself?
No, because he's got a lot of feelings that are so anti-Hasidish.
I'm not so sure I agree with that. I'm not so sure. I mean, I don't know him. I never met him.
I met him. I know
okay.
him.
So you can speak about that more authoritatively than I can.
The point is, though, that the man, he wanted to express himself the best way he knew how.
Yeah.
And that was the only way he could do it.
Yes. This is true. But let's talk more about
the book
this.
About Hasidim. He wanted to express about Shem, so he wrote a book, and he wanted together with Buber to take out altogether an anthology of Hasidim. So it's a very complex, like everything that I know, it's very complex.
Yes.
And religion is complex, and to try to pester him and make him, keeping mitzvot or not keeping mitzvot, he knew it all.
Yes, he did.
And he stuck to it, but not with a big,
Yes. Let's look at what he does in the story. Look at the story itself. First of all, his emphasis on the old man, he calls him a pashut, somebody simple, and he calls him a tamim, another version of, somebody who's very simple. That's how he portrays him. There is a lack of ritual practice. And now we come back to people's point about how he doesn't want the talis, he doesn't want the tefillin, he doesn't pronounce the words properly when he's davening. He says, I'll get to it. When I get to Israel, then I'll pray to you properly. There's no act of Torah study in this story at all, which is the trademark of Agnon's Misnagdim.
That's another connection to the title, by the way, Mavri Tzedek.
What do you mean?
He's a Tilamid.
Oh, that's interesting. So the cycle of saying Tehillim.
Could
be, but we don't find him saying Tehillim either.
No, but he said, I mean, that's the Yehudit Pashut.
Right. I hear you. He has, though, despite being a simple person, he has holiness. You see it in jail. When he's under arrest, he takes the mystic's position as a Yored Merkava. Yored Merkava is a mystical term from Midrashim that are called the Heichalot. They're about God's sanctuary, where the angels are. To be a Yored Merkava means that you are somebody who wants to see the angels. And what I'm talking about is when it says that he put Rosho Bein Birkav, his head between his knees in the prison. If you take a look on the sheet, source number 15, a lot of people try to associate this source with Agnon. This is Eliyahu. After the whole incident on Mount Carmel, where he gets the Jews to believe in God for a time, then he ends the drought and brings rain. And look at Eliyahu's posture when he brings rain. In source number 15, he lowered himself to the ground, and he placed his face between his knees. So some think that that's an association. However, Professor Roman Katzman argues compellingly that it's not. Because, first of all, Agnon's phrase was not panav bein birkav. It was rosho bein birkav. Not his face, but his head. More to the point, though, can you think of someone who's less of an Eliyahu than the old man in the story? Eliyahu is a force of nature. Eliyahu, in that story, is bringing the thunder and bringing rain. When Eliyahu doesn't like what's going on, he rages. the old man,
like Job.
Yeah, that's not like Job. Eliyahu, the old man is not an Eliyahu. So Katzman makes a convincing argument that is not what's going on here, but rather it's a mystic's position. Because going all the way back to the period of the Gaonim, more than 1,000 years ago, the position of Rosho Bein Birkav, head between his knees, was not how you survive a nuclear attack. Rather, it was what a mystic would do as part of communing with the heavens. If you take a look at source number 16, this is from the period of the Gaonim. And perhaps you know that many of the scholars thought that one who is proper in many of the identified and clarified traits, when he wishes to look upon the Merkava, the divine chariot, and to gaze into the Heichalot of the celestial Malachim, there are ways, fasting on Nona days, placing his head between his knees and chanting to the ground many songs and praises, which are clarified. Those who can read the Hebrew, songs and praises, Shirot v'tishbachot, which was the same phrase as was used in the story for the old man's songs to God. So the Agnon, I believe, is channeling that idea, that it's a mystic's position, and what he's saying is, the old man may not have ritual, he may not have Torah scholarship, but he is holy, and he is in the realm of the angels. And not only that, more than that, take a look at source number 17, because I've known for sure did. It's a passage in the Talmud about prayer. The story goes, Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, who is known in the Talmud as a miracle worker, went to study with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan's son was ill, and he said, "My son Hanina, pray for mercy for him and he will live." He said to Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, "I want you to daven for my son." And he placed his head, Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, placed his head between his knees, asked for mercy, and he lived. It worked. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, "You know, had I pressed my head between my knees all day long, they wouldn't have paid any attention to me. It wouldn't have worked for me." And his wife says to him, "What's the matter? Is he greater than you are?" To which he says, "No, but he is like a regular servant for the king, and I'm like a visiting noble who comes in on occasion when he needs something." But the point that I'm bringing here is the idea of the person who is pleading with God in prayer, and God will answer. The image of the head between the knees is drawn from there, and one other place where we see it is source number 18, the classic story of Elazar ben Derdiah. Elazar ben Derdiah is a Jew who sins, in particular with a sin of promiscuity, goes after every opportunity he can find until one day, long story, not for right now, he decides to repent, and he turns to the forces of nature to help him in his repentance. He thinks he can't appeal to God. And he says to the mountains, "Pray for me." And the mountains say, "Sorry, it's not for us to do that. We have our own business." The rivers, "Pray for me. We have our own business." And so on and so on. And finally, he concludes with what you see in source number 18. He said, "Ein adavar taloy el abi," it depends only on me. And he placed his head between his knees and cried out in tears until his soul left him. And a small voice emerged saying, "Rabbi Elazar ben Derdiah is prepared for life in the next world." This is the means of appealing to God successfully, and God takes care of him. And what you see here then, my second layer to the story, my first layer to the story is victim of injustice. My second layer here is the image of the Jew who may be simple, but whose heart is beloved before God. To use the phrase that the sages use, I brought it for you in source number 19, Rachmana liba bai. What God wants is a person's heart. So your second layer is a play for Chassidus. And no, you can't oversimplify Agnon and say he's on one side and not on the other. Agnon is too smart for that and too sophisticated for that. But his message here, I believe, is a strongly Chassidish message.
Why does he need Jesus?
That's what we're getting to. You know what it's like? It's like when they have an infomercial and they want to get people to stay. And so you keep on pushing it down the line. But I'm getting there. Just not there yet. Third layer in the story is Jewish assimilation and Christian help. And this gets us a little bit towards the Christian imagery. Germany of the 1920s is a time of heavy assimilation, and that started, you know, more than 100 years earlier. And it's a period when a lot of Jews are looking to Berlin as the new Jerusalem. Avnon wrote stories about the appeal of Christianity back at that time. You're familiar with the story of the lady and the peddler?
Yeah.
That is a weird story.
It's the one right after the one.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's funny. So everyone's read it. They don't mind if I give the spoiler, right?
No spoiler, because every time we read it, it's like we never read it before.
Okay, so she's a vampire. Does that not bother you? I've known her as a vampire story. Who knew? The Bela Lugosi could have starred. That's okay.
Well, I just wanted to say, I see that as the death of a salesman, really.
Yeah.
Well,
it is the death of a salesman. Except, right. Except she dies in the end. But if you take a look at source number 20, Professor Netta Stahl makes an interesting point in her book, Other and Brother, Jesus in the 20th Century Jewish Literary Landscape, which I was going to do as the title of my memoir. The Lady and the Peddler is not a story about Jesus, but rather a story about the Jewish self and what happens to it when it gives itself away for the sake of assimilating into the Christian world. Following the encounters with Jesus, the Jew realizes his own foreignness. He also realizes the threat embodied in Christianity. In other words, this is a theme for Agnon, seeing Christianity as a threat as the Jew embraces it. And I think you see that here in the story. The Jew trusts Yeshu with his money, right? And it's taken away from him.
The Jew
also true. The Jew expects the court to be just, and it is unjust with a picture of the smiling Jesus looking on. And in the end, the Jew still thinks that it's Jesus bringing him into Israel, but as the story ends, it's not even him. It's a group of malachim. It's a group of angels. But it's not even him. It's the malachim who are doing it, but the Jew has embraced Christianity. And so what Agnon is doing here is saying, don't do that. Don't go for that. The Christian is not the source of your help and your hope. That's a major piece here within the story. And, you know, with the first two layers, I gave you a source to show you that it was a Jewish message, but I don't think that's really necessary on this one. So your first three layers now are the victim of injustice, number one. Number two, that God is looking for the heart. And number three, Jewish assimilation and relying on Christian help and the fallacy involved. But now let's get to the fourth one, because that's where we'll really see what Agnon was doing with his Christian imagery. And this is something that he said himself. In order to give us Agnon's own statement of what he was doing in the story, remember, 1917, the British issued the Balfour Declaration. Jews have a right to have a homeland in this state of Israel. But he didn't use the word state. Right, they don't call it the state of Israel. But that's the message. But then you get to 1921 and the white paper. Right, there were a few white papers. But take a look at source number 21, which I pulled from the Jewish Virtual Library. Nice website. The first official manifesto interpreting the Balfour Declaration, it was issued on June 3, 1922, after the Haycraft Commission of Inquiry published its findings on the Arab riots of 1921. Although the white paper stated that the Balfour Declaration could not be amended and that the Jews were in Palestine by right, it reduced the area of the mandate by excluding the area east of the Jordan River, which was given to the Emir Abdullah. This document also established the principle of economic absorptive capacity as a factor for determining the immigration quota of Jews to Palestine. In other words, right before Agnon publishes this story, the British have taken the teeth out of the Balfour Declaration, partitioning the land, imposing an economically based quota on Jewish arrival in the land. And what Agnon is doing here, as reported by Arela Abramson, as reported by Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs as well, is he's writing this story as a response to this decision about splitting Mandate Palestine. Take a look at source number 22, where Abramson gives you Agnon's response. Remember the open letter that we read in the beginning, the letter to Agnon? How could you do this? Are you embracing Christianity? What is this about? Agnon sits down with his critics, which he never does. He usually likes people to wonder about what he's doing in his story. Not in this case. He was so concerned about the misunderstanding of this story that he actually explained himself. And he said, "Hu nechtav," number 22. It was written as a response to the partition of mandatory Israel between the eastern side of the Jordan and western Israel. This response contained expression of disappointment in the promises of the nations, given via the Balfour Declaration and then annulled. That's what the story is meant to be. And it's very interesting, because I read a criticism of Abramson's piece by Professor Harkavy, Professor Tzvi Harkavy, who's an unknown expert, bashed Abramson's article from start to finish. He says she took all the things that she had in there that were good from other people, including me, and she didn't give credit. He's very down on her article. And on this piece, he says, where did you invent that idea that Agnon actually gave this explanation? Where did you see it? However, by Jeffrey Sachs, in a YouTube video, which I put in source number 4, I gave you the link, actually has the text of Agnon's statement. It's 16 minutes into the video. He reads from a letter from Agnon explaining that this story is meant to express his opinion about the Balfour Declaration and Jews who rely on it, which gives you a new twist on the Chometz Ben Yayin image. The Chometz Ben Yayin, right? Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, making an alliance with the Romans. That's what the old man is. The old man is the Jew who has made an alliance with the Romans, thinking this is how we are going to get to the land of Israel. The church is going to be our friend. The non-Jews are going to be our friend. And he is let down by the Christians, especially if you take that he's being flown there by Jesus, who drops him, right? That's the ultimate of being let down. But that's the idea. He thought they're going to help him save his money to go to the land of Israel, and in fact they try to take it away from him. He claims the money, right? And they put him in jail. And then they take him there and they drop him. That's what Agnon is doing here. It's not a flirtation with Christianity. It is a critique of Jewish flirtation with Christianity. It's a critique of Jewish reliance on them.
You're going to say, and there's another hint to that, yeah, in the use of the term Umot HaOlam with the kupa.
Mm-hmm.
He says that the kupa is placed there like as they do in Umot HaOlam.
Yes.
Umot HaOlam is all the nations.
Right.
What he's talking about is a very particular nation.
Right.
He's talking about Britain, and he's talking about a Christian nation.
Right.
Britain is a Christian.
Yes. Yes. Good.
But isn't he too simple to see the connection?
What do you mean?
The character in the story.
Yeah, he doesn't get it.
It's just so beshoot.
Yes.
He wouldn't get that.
No.
He wouldn't see that.
No, he learns the lesson by experience.
There weren't enough people to settle the West Bank, let alone the East Bank.
I'm not getting into a political conversation about what could have been, because you don't want that.
In 22, the gates of Palestine were open for anybody, for any Jew who wanted to come.
Correct.
In 22. Later on, maybe 27 or 29, when they had the riots, that's when they started maybe clamping down.
Well, you had riots at different times over the years, but I'm still not going into that debate. But the message here, once again, of not relying on the nations to help us achieve our land is a classic Tanakh message. I brought you a few examples of it in source number 23. One from Echa, from Lamentations, about the empty hope that we had in the nations around us, Ezra Tenu Hevel. Right? The second one from Malachim Bet about how King Pul from Ashur, from Assyria, comes into the land, and the Jewish king Menachem bribes him to keep the kingdom in his hands, and of course it doesn't work out. The Assyrians come in and take it anyway. this is the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Yisrael. Another reference in the prophet Hosea about attempting to make covenants. Yeshaya, Isaiah criticizes first King Ahaz and then King Hezekiah for attempts to make alliances with the nations around us. This is a constant drumbeat in Tanakh. You rely on God. You don't rely on the nations around you to try to gain security in the land.
Isn't Agnon very often in many of his stories and his characters, isn't he really highlighting the isolation of the Jew?
Oh, yeah.
In every way?
Oh, yes. I would agree with that idea. Absolutely. So there, and your Pushka fits in with the story as well. He thinks he's putting his money in the Pushka. He's turning it over to the British. The last layer in the story, and I know that it's 4 minutes late, but I hope we're still okay? We can keep on pushing forward a little bit? Okay. The last layer, Zionism itself in this story is initially a secular religion for the old man. And now we've finally come back. I told you I was going to come back to it. I come back to the question of his religious adherence in the different parts of the story. He's cold to ritual Judaism. I would not read him as being non-practicing. I don't think that's consistent. But he's cold to ritual. The talis and the tefillin don't do anything for him. He says, I just want to be buried in the land. And now finally I come back to what I've been waiting for. If you take a look at source number 24, the story of Ula. Ula is one of the sages. He regularly travels to Israel, but he dies outside of Israel. They inform Rabbi Elazar, his compatriot. He says, you, Ula, you're going to die on impure soil, quoting a verse from Amos. Rabbi Elazar was then informed that Ula's casket had arrived in Israel. And he said, it's too late. One who is absorbed while alive cannot be compared to one who is absorbed after death. The klita is very different. You don't need an ulpan for starters. It's a negative that he didn't make it while alive. I also brought you in 25 a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud criticizing people who only wish to be buried in the land of Israel. When the casket arrives in Israel, you're bringing tum'ah, you're bringing impurity into the land. It's not a pure aliyah. That's not, but that's what he has in the beginning. And he splits his money half for his needs and half for aliyah. And I noted for you a passage in source number 26. I actually didn't translate it. But the story of Hillel, who used to split his money half for his family and half to be able to enter the study hall. Here, it's half for his needs and half for aliyah. His study hall is going to Israel. He says, I can't pray properly now. When I get there, I will. He fasts Bahab, the Monday, Thursday, Monday fasts. But again, not for ritual purposes, but in order to be able to save money. At the middle of the night, he rises. What was Tikkun Chatzot? Why did people rise in the middle of the night classically? Not to study. To mourn for the loss of the temple, to cry and to weep for the loss of the temple. In the Talmud, King David rises at midnight to sing to God. But but historically, people rose at midnight to cry over the loss of the temple. He rises at midnight and he's dancing for joy with his kikon.
But when the Jews leave Egypt,
they also leave at midnight.
They leave at midnight, and they don't leave as a disorganized mob. They leave as a mass movement with their degels and their tribes all lined up. They're moving towards Israel in a very purposeful way.
So I would adjust that slightly, because they don't leave at midnight. Midnight is when the firstborn Egyptians die. They don't leave until the day.
The next day?
Yeah, they leave during the day. The text makes a very point of saying, Be'etzem hayom hazeh, in the heart of the day. They don't leave at midnight.
We heard some lectures that Agnon was. My two views about Zionism, whether it was like Gil Hashem or it was Avodah Kodesh, to break the land. And he wasn't, because he went up to Germany, if it didn't have that magical fire, he may have stayed there. So,
I read Agnon as a very fierce lover of the land.
No.
A fierce lover of the land. I mean, when you read stories like Me'oyev La'ohev, where he emphasizes that you have to come to the land seriously in order to build, or else you will be buffeted about by the wind and chased out. I mean, he made all
the secular aspect of Israel.
I have to admit, I see him as a staunch lover of the land and a believer in building it up. That's the way I read it. I'm not an expert. I don't want to pretend to be.
Just wanted to add that I agree very much with you, but I think he was very aware of all the shortcomings. He wrote it about them, but that did not diminish his love of Israel.
Yeah.
I think he was too aware of
but
all
he was things. A secular Jew. I knew him as a little girl. He was a secular Jew. He did not admit to orthodoxy per se.
So I am not...
I think that in many ways it upset him a lot because he wanted to see a state that was a state and not just Dublin or whatever he...
So I'm not clear on... And first of all, I obviously didn't know him. And so I don't have the personal experience of it. But what I do know is the following. Number one, his daughter, in her conversations about him, which you can watch online, it's on YouTube, talks about him getting up in the morning, putting on tefillin, and davening.
Later on.
There are different phases in his life, and it's not for me to judge him in any case. That's not my point. My point is to say that I don't think you can separate him from observance. I think calling him secular may be an overreach. That would be my gut, but again, I'm not making a claim. Sorry? No, not in 1922. More though, within this, there's an image which I couldn't find anybody explain, but I think I got it. You read the line about the dancing? The one in which he describes him as dancing not like those who dance up in the heavens, and not like the one who dances and you leave him in one corner and you find him in the other corner, but rather dancing around his shoulders and his shoulders surrounding him. And I read that and said, this has to mean something, but I can't figure out what in the world this is. I mean, the part that's obvious...
He lived in an area that was absolutely not Orthodox. Yeah.
Okay, he lived in Tapia.
He was my neighbor, I know exactly.
Okay.
But apparently that didn't bother him.
So, I don't think that's inconsistent with anything we're saying.
I can't.
I don't think that's inconsistent with what we're saying. And we will...
What I'm trying to say is that he had so many facets to him.
Yes. Yes.
And that's why we have to sort of maybe stand back and look at this, and then look at that.
Yeah.
And then look at that. That's the only way we'll explain it.
Mm-hmm. No, I would agree with that. That he's definitely complicated, but I want to go back to the dancing. This image is a really important image. The image of dancing up in the heavens, if you go back to the writings of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, which he was very familiar with, various Hasidic groups, including Lubavitch, it shows up in his writings, Breslov, Lubavitch, quite a few of them, describes dancing as a step-by-step leaping up to the heavens, using language that's very similar to the language Agnon uses about those who dance up in the heavens. The image of jumping from one corner of the room to the other is the easy one, because that's straight out of the Talmud. Rabbi Akiva is described as praying. When he prayed privately, not communally, but privately, he would start out in one corner of the room, and with all of the bowing, he would end up in the other corner of the room. So what Agnon is describing is that the old man is not like the Hasidim or dancing in some celestial way. He's not like Rabbi Akiva, who's dancing in prayer, starting in one corner of the room and ending up in the other. It's about himself. He dances within himself. His shoulders are around him, and it's not a religious type of an experience. However, he is drawn to religion in the process. Because when he's awaiting trial, as we said, he takes the mystic's pose, right? His head between his knees. He is the arayed Merkava. He wants to see the divine chariot. He puts his head between his knees like Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, in the position that is associated with prayer and of repentance. He finally gets up at midnight and cries. His tikkun chatzot, his midnight prayer, is a legitimate one at that point, and he turns his face to Jerusalem, which is the phrase that's used way back in the book of Daniel to describe how he used to pray facing Jerusalem. he moves. The old man moves. In the beginning of the story, I don't think he's anti-religious, but religion isn't doing anything for him. And he comes to it in the course of the story. And that's an idea that we find in Rav Kook. And we know the influence of Rav Kook on Agnon. That's something that we've seen elsewhere, we've talked about. But if you take a look at source number 29, Rav Kook speaks about, he says, if at a certain time there should be found an arousal whereby people will speak only of the spirit of the nation and will attempt to negate the spirit of God, what should the righteous of the generation do? To rebel against the spirit of the nation, even verbally, and to reject its assets? This is something impossible. The spirit of the Lord and the spirit of Israel are one. Rather, the righteous must work hard to reveal the light and the holiness in the national spirit. There is holiness within the secular Zionism as well, is a teaching of Rav Kook. And I think that that's what Agnon is seeing in the old man. Granted, it's not what we think of as Zionism, building a state and living there and so on. Understood. But the vision is absolutely a vision of having holiness within his Zionism. So those are the five layers that I'm seeing here. It's the satire of the injustice of the court. That was our first layer. It was as well the issue of, going back to my own notes to make sure I don't skip, the second layer, the ode to the simple Jew, siding with the Hasidim about the simple Jew and his holiness. It's about Jewish assimilation and turning to Christianity and how it doesn't work. It's about not relying on the alliances with England, and frustration with the Balfour Declaration. This is where your Christian imagery comes into the story. And then finally, Zionism as a secular religion that will lead the person, the old man, to Judaism. In the end of the story, the old man is redeemed. They come to find him and he's missing from jail, which is found in a midrash I brought you in number 30 about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva dies in the Roman prison and Eliyahu Hanavi takes him out of the jail and they come in the morning and Rabbi Akiva is gone. And yes, I'm aware there's another Christian layer to this with somebody else who they came in the morning and he was gone. I get it. He's also escorted by malachim, by angels, which the Talmud describes for the righteous. When they die, that they are escorted by the righteous. I brought it for you in source number 31. But the last part, and again, I didn't see this in people who write about the story, but it's so clear cut. Where is he buried? Where is he buried? In Jerusalem. The old man. Not, of course, in Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem. You could not bury
anything else.
No one was allowed to be buried in the old city in Jerusalem. Classically, as I brought you from the Tosefta in source number 32, the only ones buried there were the kings of the house of David and the prophetess Huldah. We didn't bury anybody in the old city. All the cemeteries, the famous cemeteries of Jerusalem, are outside the old city. But he gets buried in Jerusalem, which is a statement about the redemption of the old man in the story. Agnon is surely well aware of this. He is presenting us a picture of the old man redeemed. And that's going back to what I said at the beginning from Gershom Scholem, the idea that there is sadness, but there's also consolation here within this story. This old man, this Job who has suffered so much, by the end of the story, has received a level of redemption. So I went on for a long time here, but I hope that it was worthwhile. I thought that was at the end of the story.
This is Jerusalem. The question is, what does he mean? What does he mean by Jerusalem? Does he mean Greater Jerusalem, or does he mean?
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. You could read it as him being buried outside. You're right. The wording is not precise. They took him and buried him that night because you don't leave the dead overnight in Jerusalem. So you're right. He could have been buried outside, and this doesn't force that.
It's redemption, nevertheless.
It's redemption, nevertheless. But you're right. You're right. It doesn't have to be that he's buried
in the right place.
Okay. Yes.
May I add a good compliment to the thoroughness of the exposition? I wonder if I could just shift the perspective to left field for a moment.
Please.
Last year, I had the pleasure of listening to a professor
in a speech sponsored by the Yiddish Society here in Toronto. She's a professor from University of California, very competent scholar on Jewish history, and she talked about the daring aspect of Yiddish research in the 18th and 19th centuries, and also in the early 20th centuries, and pointed out that this very daring aspect of Yiddish scholarship also comprised translations of